Today on Against the Grain, Clarence Thomas is Donald Trump's favorite Supreme Court justice, which might confirm the liberal view that Thomas is simply a toady of the right. But scholar Corey Robin argues that Thomas is a complex thinker and skilled rhetorician, whose ideas originate in Black nationalism. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with Robin about how Thomas's pessimism about the intractability of racism speaks uneasily to our times. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas is a controversial figure, a stalwart member of the right, famously accused by Anita Hill of sexual harassment. But as Corey Robin argues, liberals and those on the left tend to miss one of the most remarkable aspects of Thomas, and that's his Black nationalism, combining patriarchy, capitalism, and a deep pessimism about the insurmountability of racism. In The Enigma of Clarence Thomas, published by Metropolitan Books, Robin delves into Thomas's history and writings to shed light on this complicated and unsettling political figure. A scholar of the right, Robin teaches political science at Brooklyn College and is the author of The Reactionary Mind and Fear, and we welcome him back to the program. Corey, can you give us a sense of how influential Thomas is, a justice who's often given short shrift?
Yeah, he's increasingly influential, thanks in part to the appointments of Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch. There's now a solid, very right-wing majority on the court that is prepared to move in directions that Clarence Thomas has been pushing for a very long time. For many years, he was writing solo dissents, but that has begun to change. So the combination of this very solid right-wing majority and the fact that he is the most senior justice on the court, which means that should Chief Justice Roberts ever not be aligned with Thomas, Thomas then has the right to assign opinions. So he has become, he has come into his moment, you might say.
Well, what is fascinating is that I think we as the public have the sense that we know Clarence Thomas, or at least those who witnessed the Anita Hill accusations of sexual harassment, which involved all sorts of intimate disclosures. And yet, really, in so many ways, we don't seem to know him at all. What is his background?
So he was born in Pinpoint, Georgia, which is a small coastal community not far from Savannah that had been founded by ex-slaves. And he moved to Savannah when he was 6 years old and was raised by his grandfather. He came from an extraordinary poor background, but his grandfather was something of a self-made man and owned his own business, and a very stern authoritarian figure to whom Thomas would later attribute much of his success in life. Pushed Thomas very hard, and Thomas eventually graduates and heads north to Holy Cross in 1968, and he became politicized there, very active as part of a cohort of young Black male students who were inclined in a kind of Black nationalist, Black power direction. He was active on campus and quite militant and really one of the student leaders. And it's out of that experience, I argue in the book, that he develops many of the lifelong conceptions, particularly about race, that he will keep with him as he makes his journey to the right, which begins roughly in the mid-1970s. After he has not only graduated Holy Cross, but then Yale Law School, where he goes between 1971 and 1974.
You argue that there are three areas that are central to Thomas's thinking: race, capitalism, and the Constitution. And you organize your book the enigma of Clarence Thomas along these lines of these ideas. And I wanted to ask you about the question of race. How did his ideas, which you've just touched on, but how did they coalesce? And what would you say are the central elements of his worldview?
Well, at the heart of Thomas's view about race is that it is ineradicable. And by race, I really mean here racism. Thomas is politicized, you know, as I said, in 1968, 1969, which is, from the point of view of the history of the Black freedom struggle, is kind of the beginning of the end of the struggle, at least in terms of its phases of victory. It's an increasingly militant moment. And Thomas really imbibes a lot of Black nationalist ideas. And what he takes from them is this sense that Black fate is something that is apart from the rest of America, that African Americans will never be able to fulfill their destiny, their interests, their values and purposes within the confines of white America, within the confines of a white American state. And so what they must do is withdraw, develop separate institutions, cultivate Black, independent Black leadership, particularly Black male leadership, cease to involve themselves in the political process as a whole because it is overwhelmingly dominated by whites. And that really is at the heart of Thomas's vision of racism, this sense of Black apartness and the sense that Blacks and African Americans have a kind of fugitive destiny in this country that just simply will not be fulfilled by the dominant institutions.
I think it might come as a surprise to many listeners that this Black nationalism, which, as you say, originated in his student days, that's one of the fundamental dimensions of Clarence Thomas's worldview. And I wanted to ask you how this, in some ways, has been overlooked by commentators, including people on the left, because clearly there is a long tradition of Black conservatism dating back to, you know, Booker T. Washington, you know, all the way to Louis Farrakhan. Why is it that Thomas's Black nationalist conservatism is so invisible to us?
Well, I think a couple of reasons. First of all, I think many people on the left associate, African Americans as a whole with the left, and particularly among people who are white on the left, I think ascribe a kind of unity of values to African Americans, such that anybody who would break out of that consensus is not even intelligible, I think, to many white people. I think there's also an assumption that, and this transcends right and left, that Black nationalism is inherently a project of the left. Now, there have certainly been many Black nationalists on the left, but it's a complicated tradition that has had many conservative versions. So I think both the fact of a Black person who's conservative, I think, is a hard thing for many people to grasp without resorting to cliches like race traitor to his race or a sellout and things like that. I think that's a tough thing for people to grasp, is being Black and conservative in the first place. But I think the idea of being Black nationalist and conservative is very difficult to grasp. And then I'll add, and I say this a little bit hesitantly, but it's in the book and it's important, I think there is a bit of racism in the view that a lot of people have, particularly people on the left, of Thomas. And in this regard, and I think one of the more disturbing aspects of the research that I stumbled across, there's a kind of a mirror to how Thurgood Marshall was often viewed by American political commentators, even liberal political commentators, who tended to dismiss him when he was on the court as kind of a lightweight, as somebody who wasn't particularly smart, as somebody who relied upon his clerks or Justice Brennan for his opinions. A lot of the same tropes that are mobilized against Clarence Thomas were mobilized against Thurgood Marshall, and again, not simply by conservatives. So I think there's a couple of reasons that just make Thomas hard to read for people, and not, I shouldn't even say hard to read, because he actually writes with an almost sort of deceptive clarity and directness. So he's not hard to read, but I think he doesn't fit a lot of the grids that people have in their minds. And I should say that also applies to conservatives. I mean, they have misread him as kind of a straight down the line conservative who's very intelligible to them. And I think they miss quite a bit of what's going on in his jurisprudence as well.
Well, which leads me to the question of how he could be appointed to the positions that he was by Reagan. And obviously he ended up appointed as a Supreme Court justice from the right. Was his black nationalism not visible to the conservative establishment, or did they realize what they were getting?
That's a really interesting and complicated question. And I guess I'll answer it in two parts. I mean, I think the first is that you cannot underestimate just the simple opportunism of the Republican establishment, particularly in the 1970s and 1980s and 1990s, when it came to questions of race. It was it almost seems like a time so far away, it's hard to remember this, but conservatives and Republicans were very interested in having front men, essentially, who were black, who could reassure their white constituencies in the suburbs that, you know, we, the Republican Party, the conservative movement, are not just narrow-minded racists. And so people like Clarence Thomas were, instrumental value to the Republican establishment. So I think that's one part of the story and will be very familiar to the left. I think the harder and more complicated part of the story is that there are and were aspects of black nationalism that Republicans and conservatives thought were pretty harmonious with the right. Richard Nixon, for instance, frequently made appeals to the kind of black nationalist turn. And said, you know, and spoke about black power. And there were advertisements in Essence magazine and other black magazines, Jet magazine, where the Republicans and conservatives would say, you know, what is black power? What black power really is black capitalism. When they made these appeals, it was, again, very instrumental and cynical and strategic. But it played to something that was in the black nationalist tradition, namely the sense of not pursuing the goals of the African-American community through organized political and legal mechanisms, but instead by building up, let's say, black businesses. And there were many black nationalists. Again, this was one of the surprises in the research that I came across, but particularly in the early 1970s, and black power activists who were very interested in experimenting with capitalist institutions, with the idea of black-owned businesses, with the idea of black entrepreneurialism. So when Clarence Thomas starts voicing some of his sort of more conservative arguments against politics and in favor of the marketplace and business, that's a language that, you know, to quote Margaret Thatcher on Gorbachev, you know, they could, the conservatives could do business with and found familiar. So I think Thomas's trajectory and his rise was both cynical and instrumental on both the part of the Republican and conservative establishment, but also did reflect a kind of deeper traffic in ideas that could find points of contact between conservatism on the one hand and this black nationalism on the other hand.
Political scientist Corey Robin is my guest. He is the author of The Enigma of Clarence Thomas. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. One of the things that you point to in The Enigma of Clarence Thomas is that the right often presents itself anyway as seeing race in colorblind terms. That is, that there's no point at looking at people's races, that, you know, the right positions itself as above that. Now, many people would say that's a very cynical posture because the right has a long history of overt and covert racism. But that has generally been the way that the contemporary right has framed its attitude toward race. And the left, on the other hand, has put forward the idea that race and racism operate in deep structural ways in society, and that we have to acknowledge that to even think about how to change the world. How do you situate Clarence Thomas in that dichotomy between left and right?
He scrambles it, to be honest with you. Thomas definitely rejects the colorblind vision of the right, and has repeatedly. At most, what he would say is that the state's policies should be colorblind. But unlike many conservatives, he does not believe that that reflects a colorblind society or that it will lead to a colorblind society. And this has been a very strong position of his throughout his right turn in the 70s, 80s, and on the court. He is extraordinarily race conscious. And that's very important. And also sees racism, as I said earlier, as permanent, as ineradicable, as systemic, as pervasive throughout society, oftentimes in places that people don't want to look at. So I think that aspect is very strong. On the other hand, I would not say that he has a structural theory of race. I think he has very much a psychological theory of race. For him, racism is about racial animus. It can be both conscious racial animus and unconscious. So it's not that it just has to be overt. He believes that there's unconscious racism. But it's a very sort of psychological idea. That focuses on things like racial stigmas and the way Black people are thought about by white people.
Well, can you give us some examples of how that way of coming at race and that deep pessimism that racism can be eradicated has shaped the decisions that he has made on the court?
Yeah, I think you could look at, so for instance, some of his, a lot of his decisions around education. Thomas does not believe in legal segregation, but he comes awfully close sometimes to arguing for separate but equal, which was the standard, never even honored, but at least was the formal legal standard of Jim Crow. He has said that he believes Black people learn better when they are not mixing with white people, Black students, that when you put Black and white students together, you will get conflicts because of inherent sort of racial tensions that just get expressed, and believes that Black students on the whole both learn better and do better and achieve more pretty much when they're apart from white people. And these are in some of his opinions, like I said, about education and integration. When it comes to juror selection, this is a question about whether or not if you're a defendant or the prosecutor, whether you have the right to strike down potential jurors. It's called juror preemption. And Thomas's position, which is very different from both liberals and conservatives, is that racial bias is so strong when you get a group of white people together on a jury that it should be the prerogative of a Black defendant to be able to strike down a potential juror who is white, even when there's no evidence that of that juror being him herself or herself racist. This is a position that nobody on the court is willing to take, but it's one that Thomas takes quite strongly, and in fact did it quite recently last term in Flowers versus Mississippi. So those are just some of these cases. I mean, we could cite others in about the need to segregate races in prisons, And then, you know, that's not even beginning to touch the whole question of affirmative action, where he has a very different analysis from both left and right.
Well, tell us about that. How does he see affirmative action?
So the typical conservative critique of affirmative action, which you've almost, you know, already alluded to, is that it violates the formal rules of colorblindness and therefore is discriminatory, and that it also is that it creates a set of victims who are white. That is not Thomas's view. Thomas's view is that affirmative action is just the kind of most up-to-date form of white supremacy. That is, that the primary goal, he says, of the elites who administer affirmative action, and he's thinking particularly at elite universities and law schools, that their primary commitment is to maintain their elite status, that they want to maintain selectivity and exclusivity. And that if they really cared about diversity, what they would simply do is change their admission standards. For starters, maybe get rid of the LSAT, because the LSAT has been shown to be often, you know, racially skewed in all sorts of ways. And if you got rid of the LSAT and had different kinds of admission standards, you would diversify your institution very simply. But these institutions are not willing to do that. And because, as Thomas says, you know, they're committed to their exclusivity and their selectivity and elitism. So what they do instead is these programs of diversity where they are allowed to maintain. And again, he's always thinking when he says they of these elites as white elites. They are allowed to maintain a kind of racial discretion. That is, they get to select those African-Americans and students of color whom they think could be one of us. And this has the perverse effect, says Thomas, of increasing and enhancing and aggravating the white sense of racial superiority and paternalism, such that when these elites select certain African Americans to be part of their institutions, they believe, these elites, that those African Americans owe their presence there to kind of white paternalism. And Thomas believes that all African Americans are tainted by this association, whether they were selected for reasons of affirmative action or not. And let me just add one other thing, which is that, you know, many conservatives will make the claim that affirmative action is the thing that creates racial stigmas today. And liberals rightly, in my view, respond, that's preposterous. These racial stigmas predate affirmative action. Thomas, interestingly enough, accepts that point of view, that these racial stigmas predate affirmative action. But his argument is that far from eliminating racial stigmas, affirmative action only perpetuates those stigmas. And he makes a very interesting comparison, which liberals and leftists often make, to alumni preferences. And he says he's fully aware that to the children of alums get preferences, you know, at elite institutions. But the point is that those preferences do not create or enhance or perpetuate any kind of stigma. It's only when those when preferences are applied to Black people that they perpetuate these stigmas. So for Thomas, affirmative action really becomes a kind of continuation of very old and ancient forms of racial paternalism and white racial paternalism and prerogatives, and leave African Americans in this almost abject position where they are dependent upon the good wishes and goodwill of well-meaning white people.
How does Thomas see the state? You were just talking about white elites and white paternalism. How does Clarence Thomas understand the state in racialized terms?
I mean, put simply, he sees the state as the premier institution of white rule. It always has been, and it always will be. And this can lead him into some very dark and disturbing places when it comes to something like voting rights. In the 1980s, Thomas gave a lengthy interview to Juan Williams, the journalist, which was then written up in a fascinating profile in the Atlantic Monthly. And in that interview, Thomas talks about what a misbegotten idea he believes it is for African Americans to try to organize themselves politically and to gain power through the vote. And he says, you know, just think about what would happen if African Americans exercised power collectively through the political process. And he says, we are the most despised minority in this country. We are the most loathed. And if we were to, you know, try to get power in proportion to our numbers, what would happen? We'd end up on the bottom. I think he says something like, you know, with the hell beaten out of us. The only group that might do worse is Native Americans. And that view really influences how he approaches something like voting rights. Thomas believes that when African Americans try to enhance their collective voice through the vote, whether through something like gerrymandering or majority-minority districts, the only way that they can do this is through the kind of white paternalism of political elites. And he believes that all that does is to diminish Black agency and enhance white agency. And his preference is that African Americans, you know, simply put, would cease their involvement in the political sphere and get out of the business of voting rights. So, you know, that's just one example of his view of the state as a white institution when it comes to something like voting rights. Conversely, and I'll be brief about this, when the white state tries to act on behalf of Black interests through different policies, he believes that those policies ultimately are to the detriment of Black people. And he does this in particular, looks at this in the policy of eminent domain, the Commerce Clause, a whole bunch of other policies as well.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Corey Robin. He teaches political science at Brooklyn College and is the author most recently of The Enigma of Clarence Thomas. That's published by Metropolitan Books at againstthegrain.org. You can find a link to that book. We've also talked to him in the past about his books, The Reactionary Mind and Fear. So you argue, Corey, in The Enigma of Clarence Thomas, that there are some central areas of Thomas's ideas. One revolves around race. We've just been talking about that. Another is about capitalism, and of course those two are not separate, but I wanted to ask you, at what point did capitalism and the questions of markets versus the state become so important to Clarence Thomas's worldview?
It was really in the mid-1970s. He had, as I said, graduated from Yale Law School. He was in Missouri working in the state attorney general's office. He was already, I would say, politically in flux from having been a strong Black nationalist on the left to now being more questioning and was working in a Republican state attorney general's office. And he reads a book by Thomas Sowell, who is a prominent conservative African-American economist called Race and Economics. And the book has a transformative effect on him. So much so that when he hears that Sowell is going to be in town in St. Louis debating an up-and-coming law professor by the name of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Clarence Thomas makes the journey from Jefferson City to St. Louis just to hear Sowell. But the book is a fascinating book because Race and Economics, I mean, because there's a kind of hidden through line in the book. And that is Sowell's argument that, that, as I said, you know, earlier, politics has always been a sphere of white domination. But that the one sphere, the one institution that white people could never fully control and mobilize on their own behalf was capitalism itself. And Sowell has a reading of slavery that I think many historians would reject, but was important at the time, which is that the white slaveholder However sadistic and repressive and tyrannical he might be, his tyranny and his sadism was constrained by market institutions, because it would just simply prove to be too unprofitable to try to control black slaves purely through coercive means. Again, I should point out, you know, many historians now question this argument, but Thomas says that that book came to him like, you know, like manna from heaven or water in a desert. Imagine this, that here he is coming out of this intense experience of political mobilization, and like many African Americans, reaching the conclusion that we're never going to get ahead if we try the various political means, whether those are voting or elections or more radical protest and social movement and revolutionary activity. We're never going to be able to transform our situation because of the combination of racism and the fact that we're numerically a minority. So what is left to us? And if you imagine yourself as a kind of frustrated ex-radical who's African-American, you can see how a book like Souls would seem to offer you a path out of that desert. And that's exactly what Thomas sees in Capitalism. And I should say there's a kind of an autobiographical dimension to this as well, because as I mentioned, his grandfather, who played such a huge role in his life, was a black businessman and achieved a kind of stature in the Savannah black community during the 1940s and 1950s. And for Thomas, ultimately, that's what he sees as the path forward, is black men like his grandfather, strong black men, able to amass wealth and resources through their hard work and effort, that will then be able to be distributed throughout the black community. And that's really what is part a strong part of his right turn and leads to a lot of his views on the market and capitalism.
Do you find that Clarence Thomas's opinions around capitalism, do you see them as really of a piece of mainstream American conservative views on capitalism and the market? Or do you feel like the complexities of his intellectual trajectory in politics have at times led to opinions that might differ from his conservative peers?
On the whole, I think they're pretty much in sync, but I think Thomas has actually always been way out in front on a lot of these opinions. And I'll just give you two examples.
Sure.
One is the Commerce Clause. I don't want to get too technical or weedy about this, but the Commerce Clause was really has always been the centerpiece of a lot of liberal welfare state legislation and civil rights legislation, too. And in 1995, the Supreme Court, the conservative court under Rehnquist, finally puts a stop to the use of the Commerce Clause for welfare state purposes. It's the Lopez decision, which involves gun control. But it's the first time. But Thomas goes much, much further than all the conservatives on the court in really wanting to roll back the use of the Commerce Clause to regulate the economy.
And can you tell us what the Commerce Clause is?
Sure. The Commerce Clause is a part of the Constitution in Article 1 that stipulates that Congress has the right and power to regulate commerce between the states. Now, this can sound like a very narrow technical clause. It's only 8 words long. But as I said, this has been the centerpiece, this clause, of the right of Congress to regulate and create a national economy. So, for instance, the Wagner Act, which many liberals and leftists know as the piece of legislation that establishes essentially the right to form and organize a union, which is passed by Congress in 1935. The basis of the Wagner Act, there's a long opening section, is that if workers don't have the right to organize, there's going to be strikes. If there are strikes, that will disrupt the streams of the economy and commerce. Products will not be able to cross state lines. Workers will not have money to buy products with them. So therefore, Congress has the right to establish the right to join and organize a union. So that's 1935. The Civil Rights Act, many people don't realize this. The basis of the Civil Rights Act, why is it that a restaurant cannot, or a hotel cannot, discriminate against African Americans? Well, said Congress, and the Supreme Court approved this in 1965, discrimination harms the, or bridges the ability of African Americans to travel. If they cannot be assured that they can get overnight stay at an inn or be able to stop at a restaurant, they're not likely to get into their car or get on a bus and cross state lines. So the links between commerce and the power of the national government, particularly Congress, to regulate the economy are intimate. Thomas, as I said, to bring this back, you know, has really been at the forefront of trying to get the government just out of that business, and has been far, far in advance of other conservatives on the court. And one of the reasons for this is that he understood full well how central these kinds of national regulations were to African Americans. He's talked about this quite at length, about how much African American, you know, liberal African Americans have looked to Congress and its ability to regulate the national economy as somehow the agent of their deliverance. And so he really wants to get African Americans to stop thinking about the national government in those terms, to look instead to market institutions independent of the state. And so that has led him, ironically, to take positions far out in front of many conservatives on the court. What's interesting now is that despite being in this very kind of avant-garde position for many years, it seems pretty clear that minimally Justice Gorsuch would be willing to go with Thomas, but it's possible that the three other justices have been would be willing to go with him as well.
I know that you eschew the psychological, the biographical, in looking at the ideas of Clarence Thomas. But I did want to ask you whether you think that the fact that he has been out front on pushing at what's possible in terms of removing state regulation and letting the market run unfettered, if that has any relation to his history before joining the Supreme Court, because you note that rather than being sort of steeped in the world of jurisprudence, that preceding his appointment to the court, he had been very much a political actor involved in institutions and organizations of the right.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's a very fair reading of him. And it ramifies in all kinds of interesting directions. So first of all, I think when you read his opinions, they don't read like conventional Supreme Court opinions. They really read like statements of public philosophy. And I think that's quite deliberate. Thomas thinks politically, and it's not just the substance of what he argues, where he has, you know, these long sections devoted to these very race-conscious questions. It's interesting, in some of these opinions, Alito or Roberts or Gorsuch might join him for part of his opinions, but then the second that Thomas starts making these racial turns, his conservative brethren, you know, jump ship and get the hell out of there very fast. But it's not just the substance of these opinions that are very political. It's the style of argumentation. Thomas is an extraordinarily accomplished rhetorician. I would say the only two justices who even come close to him, just in terms of the directness of his attack, are Roberts and Kagan. And Thomas has said, when he was a conservative activist in the 1980s, that we have to stop looking at the law as just something as the province of lawyers. We have to start looking at law as a political weapon that can be understood by political people. And I think that's what makes his opinions oftentimes difficult, particularly for law professors to understand, because they don't have the kind of jurisprudential consistency that one oftentimes looks for. And so I think when law professors or law reporters don't see jurisprudential consistency, they think, well, he's just inconsistent. He's actually not inconsistent. He's just, the consistency is much more political and ideological. And in this regard, the comparison has been made between him and Hugo Black, who was a influential liberal Supreme Court justice in the 20th century, who Hugo Black also didn't really have much of a legal background. He was much more of a political animal. And likewise, Thomas is just an intensely political being. And I'll take it one step further. Thomas is very much an ideologue. He's somebody, Hannah Arendt at the end of The Origins of Totalitarianism says, the ideologue or ideology, somebody who's always thinking through every idea to its murderous end. And I think that's true of Thomas, that, if he begins with the premise, he wants to follow it out to its logical conclusion. Pragmatism be damned. And that's what I think, lends his opinions sometimes their kind of blood-curdling quality, is this almost delight he takes in not softening and not prettifying what are the logical implications of some of the arguments that he's making.
I'm speaking with Corey Robin about his book, The Enigma of Clarence Thomas. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So in the mid-1980s, Clarence Thomas's views about the Constitution were developed, and within his own political intellectual trajectory, they came later. How do you see those ideas? How did those ideas coalesce, and what would you say undergirds them?
At the heart of Thomas's vision of the Constitution are two ideas, in fact, and I call one of them the Black Constitution and one of them the White Constitution. The Black Constitution is the Constitution that was created by the Civil War and Reconstruction and was transformed through the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, what are called the Reconstruction Amendments, which both eliminated chattel slavery and established the right to vote, and things like the Equal Protection Clause, the Due Process Clause. And unlike many conservatives, Thomas is very interested in this, what's often called the Second Constitution, the Constitution that was transformed, Thomas will say, by the African-American struggle over emancipation. The other Constitution, the White Constitution, is the Constitution as it was established in 1789 and was the antebellum Constitution. And this is a constitution that is a much darker constitution. It's a constitution that is very much, for Thomas, framed around questions of crime and punishment, which we can talk about some more in a second. But those are the two constitutions that are really at the center of Thomas's imagination. And I think what unites both of them, and again, we can look at this more carefully in a second, is a vision of Black male authority. We in the United States have this idea what a constitution is really a kind of code, a fundamental code of legal rules. But there's a much older idea of what a constitution is, which is a kind of the means of constituting a social order, creating a society. And that's much more Thomas's idea of what a constitution does, is it creates a social order. And the heart of his social order, his preferred social order, is the restoration of Black male, Black patriarchal authority. And he sees the task of both the Black Constitution and the White Constitution as essentially restoring Black men to the kind of role, and I use the word restoring deliberately because Thomas believes that Black men have been demoted from their rightful place in the Black family, in the Black community, and he would like to see them restored to their rightful place and power.
How do you see the accusations by Anita Hill of sexual harassment that she made against Clarence Thomas connected to precisely those arguments, that view of Black manhood that you've just been laying out?
So Thomas, throughout the 1970s and 1980s, came to view liberalism as the fundamental enemy of Black men. All the things that liberals and leftists champion, things like the sexual revolution, the revolution in the rights of criminal defendants that was established by the Warren Court, and some of the economic rights and freedoms that were won by the liberal New Deal. Thomas sees all of those as essentially undermining Black male authority, Black male purpose, Black male discipline. And has always sought, you know, from the beginning of his right turn, to undo these liberal reforms. Now, in his vision, in Thomas's vision of the Black community and the forward advance of the Black community, there's never been very much room, if any at all, for Black women. Black women have at best been perceived to be a kind of passive recipients of Black male authority, but often, in Thomas's view, were thought to be kind of traitorous figures, weak-willed women, like his mother, in his view, and like his sister, in his view, who can't provide the kind of authority to Black boys that they need. And so when Anita Hill came along, it was almost as if he had been preparing for her and what she represented to him for years, in that here she was, in his view, in alliance with these white liberal organizations. And it was almost as if what he perceived as her treachery had been scripted from long before the moment when she went public with her accusations. And so when Thomas makes those famous claims in his confirmation hearings about this is a high-tech legal lynching and so forth, as I say in the book, it's very clear on the one hand that he's lying about what he had done with Anita Hill. I think that's been pretty firmly established. But nevertheless, was telling a kind of truth as he saw it about the world and this almost conspiracy between white liberal organizations and Black women, that this was a view that was deeply felt in his mind, and that the only result of that conspiracy or alliance between those two forces would be the demolition of Black men, and ultimately with that demolition, the demolition of the Black community.
I'd like to end by asking you about what Clarence Thomas's ideas represent beyond the Supreme Court. You argue in the book that he's way more influential on the Supreme Court than he's ever given credit for. But you also suggest that the contradictions of his ideas, the pessimism, that those ideas are key to understanding American politics outside of the Supreme Court. How so?
Well, if you look at Thomas's jurisprudence and the set of his opinions and what's there, there are a couple of key ideas that emerge. One is, as we've said, this really strong pessimistic view about the sort of permanence of racism, and that that America will be perpetually organized along the color line. Two, at the heart of his Black Constitution is the idea of the right to bear arms. And we see that, you know, armaments, people arming themselves. And in fact, since Trump, there's been a kind of movement among African Americans, increasing movement to arm themselves. So, you know, the right to bear arms, the centrality of gun culture in America. Third, the extraordinary plutocracy and the kind of accumulation of wealth that we see. And last, just the sort of declining participation and faith in and really faith in the possibilities of political transformation. I think once you put all those things together, Thomas's jurisprudence looks like an eerily familiar X-ray of what America has become, and that makes him, I think, more significant, as you suggest in your question, rightly so, off the court than any one opinion is significant on the court. He really has a claim to being, I think, the public philosopher of our moment. And when we start considering the overtness of racial hostility now in Trump's Republican Party, you know, people often say, how could somebody like Thomas, if he really is a black nationalist and race conscious, how could he be a part of this? But Thomas has always said that he much prefers the brutal clarity and candor and honesty of the overt white racist to the seductive obscurantism and beguiling nature of the white liberal, whose racism is obscured. And so, you know, the world today, with the kind of the overtness of racial hostility and wealth inequality and armaments, I think is Clarence Thomas's world. And I the epilogue of the book is called Clarence Thomas's America. And I do think that we get a picture of America in those opinions that has a kind of clarifying quality to them.
Corey Robin, it's been a pleasure to have you back on. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Corey Robin is the author of The Enigma of Clarence Thomas, published by Metropolitan Books at againstthegrain.org. You can find a link to that book. He teaches political science at Brooklyn College, and his other books include The Reactionary Mind and Fear. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.